This is Muse, Science and Exploration for Inquisitive Minds. This is the October 2023 edition. It's entitled Eruption. On the cover, a picture of a volcano erupting. I'm Jane Malucci, a volunteer reader for CRIS. On the inside front cover, the features, with a picture of flowing lava. Page 42, The Curious Case of the Missing Volcano. Where in the World Is It? By Abfa and Deepa Jain. 10. The Magma Hammer Strikes, Tonga's Huge Eruption, by Rachel Keogh. 16. When a Volcano Screams, Everyone Should Listen, by Bill Gorgi. 26. Io's on Fire, Volcanoes Off Earth, by Alice Andre Clark. 30. Diamonds Found Here, The Secret Sign, by Avery Elizabeth Hurt. 34. Deadly Lakes, Scary Limnic Eruptions, by Gina Hagler. 38. Big Blasts from the Past, World Changers, by Nick D'Alto. We begin on page 6 with Muse News by Elizabeth Preston. At the top of the page, a picture of a snake and three inset pictures of the same snake doing cartwheels. One of these stories is false. Can you spot which one? The answer is on page 46. Herpetology. These snakes should be in the circus. A tiny snake in Southeast Asia has an unusual trick for escaping other creatures that want to eat it. When it's scared, the snake curls into a circle and cartwheels away. People had glimpsed this trick before, but scientists recently got to see the cartwheeling and take pictures of it. The scientists had startled the animal, called a dwarf reed snake, as it was crossing a road. Immediately, the snake rolled away. The researchers caught the snake and brought it to flat ground so they could take pictures of its acrobatics. Dwarf reed snakes usually come out only at night. During the day, they like to stay hidden under rocks or logs, but if they sneak out into the sunlight, they have a handy way to flee from predators. Next, a honeybee transformer saying, "Who are you calling a toy?" Tech Desk, a multi-talented transformer. Maybe you've seen a toy that can turn from a robot into a car or a truck. You twist its limbs and head around, and it goes from walking to driving on wheels. Now, engineers have built a new kind of robot whose transformations are just as impressive. And it's no toy. It can conquer challenges in the real world. The robot is called M4 for Multimodal Mobility Morphobot. It's small and has four limbs. M4 can use those four limbs in different positions to walk, crawl, roll, tumble, and climb steep hills. It can even fly. Its four wheels flip overhead and become propellers. Next, there's pictures of elephants. One picture shows three elephants holding bananas in their trunks. On the right of it is a picture of a single elephant holding a banana, and it looks like she's about to break it in half. There's an inset picture of her working on it. And, of course, a banana peel. Snack science. How a pachyderm peels a banana. During snack time at a zoo in Berlin, Germany, one elephant does things her own way. The other elephants eat all their bananas whole, peel and all. But an Asian elephant named Peng Fa often peels her bananas like a person would. To get the peel off, Peng Fa first uses her trunk to break the banana in half. Then she picks up the pieces and shakes them to get the ripe banana out of its peel. She tosses away the peel and eats the tasty fruit. Peng Fa only peels yellow bananas. She may have learned this behavior from watching humans. She prefers to eat green bananas whole, like the other elephants do. And if keepers give her a brown banana, she just throws it away. Our next picture is the bottom of the ocean with air bubbles escaping. Earth science. Many more underwater volcanoes found. If you like volcanoes in the ocean, then we have good news. Scientists just found 19,325 more of them. It's important to know where underwater volcanoes called seamounts are. That way, people can be aware of them and submarines can avoid them. But much of the ocean floor hasn't been mapped yet. To make a better map of seamounts, scientists used satellites. From space, the satellites can see places where the ocean water is a little higher. That's because the gravity of a big volcano underneath pulls more water overhead. The 19,325 newly discovered seamounts are located all around the world. Earlier research had already found 24,643 other seamounts. That adds up to a whole lot of underwater volcanic awesomeness. Our next picture is a paper airplane casting the shadow of a jetliner. Aviation, where no paper plane has gone before. Most paper airplanes don't travel farther than across your living room or down a flight of stairs. But one company has made a plane out of paper that went a little farther. In a test flight, it traveled halfway across North America. The U.S. company wants to make vehicles out of earth-friendly materials. Its first airplane, a small propeller plane that just holds a pilot and one passenger, is made entirely from recycled paper. Engineers also sprayed the plane with a biodegradable coating that makes it resistant to water. That kept the plane from getting soggy when it was up in the clouds. Someday, the company even dreams of making a paper rocket ship that can go to space, although all that fire at liftoff will present a real challenge. The next picture has a series of potted plants with a microphone suspended above them. One plant says, "I'm feeling a little parched." Another, "Can we get some water over here, please?" Botany. The plants are talking? Your dog barks at the mail carrier. Your cat meows when it wants attention. At least your houseplants are quiet. Or are they? Some scientists wondered whether plants are really as quiet as they seem. Maybe we just haven't listened to them closely enough. The researchers put plants into soundproof boxes with sensitive microphones. They discovered that noises too high-pitched for human hearing were coming from the plants. The plants were especially noisy several days after watering. They made slightly different noises if someone had just cut their stems. But safe, well-watered plants were quieter. Are plants yelling for help when they need it? It's way too soon to say why the plants make these sounds. Scientists think the sounds might come from tiny bubbles bursting inside the plant's stems. That's the news. Go to page 46 to see if you spotted the false story. Answers, pages 6 through 9, Muse News. The false story is, where no paper plane has gone before. Page 10, The Magma Hammer Strikes, by Rachel Keough. Tonga's recent massive underwater eruption. There are more than 13,000 active volcanoes on the planet. Some erupt continuously for many years, while others erupt suddenly with little to no warning. On January 15, 2022, the world was largely caught off guard with the world's most violent volcanic eruption ever recorded with modern instruments. It occurred in Hunga-Tonga-Hunga-Ha'ape, Tonga, in the South Pacific. But HTHH, as it's now sometimes called, hadn't really come out of nowhere. This submarine volcano had erupted out of the ocean back in January 2015, creating a new island. The volcano was located 65 kilometers, 40 miles north of Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa, and joined together two small uninhabited islands called Hunga Tonga and Hunga Ha'ape. That's where the volcano's full name came from. After the 2022 eruption, small pieces of those two islands are the only parts of the volcano that remain above the water. Though these islands reached only 374 feet, 114 meters above the sea, Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'ape is huge. Rising from the seafloor, it measures 1.1 mile, 1.8 kilometers high, and is 12.4 miles, 20 kilometers wide. The underwater mountain is a part of a sweeping arc of volcanoes that form the Tongan part of the Pacific Ring of Fire. Volcanic Awakening. Between 2015 and 2021, the volcano erupted occasionally. But these events were considered relatively mild. They were the kind of eruptions that you could be within a few miles of and still be considered safe, says Kevin McKay. He is a marine geologist at the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, NIWA, in New Zealand. There was nothing that would lead us to think a major eruption would even happen, McKay adds. The unthinkable, though, did happen. Hunga Tonga Hunga Huape erupted with hundreds of times more power than an atomic bomb, according to NASA. Triggering the eruption was a massive pulse of magma. It quickly traveled up the chamber, creating tremendous pressure. Scientists described the eruption as a magma hammer. This hammer hit four times, blowing out 2.4 cubic miles, 10 cubic kilometers, of rock, ash, and sediment. The sound was so loud, it was heard in Alaska, nearly 6,000 miles, 9,656 kilometers away. The explosion sent plumes of ash, steam, and gas as high as 36 miles, 58 kilometers, into the atmosphere. This is as high as stacking 70 of the world's current tallest building, the Burj Khalifa, located in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, on top of each other. The mighty plume reached the edge of space, setting a record for the greatest volcanic eruption height ever recorded on Earth. This volcano killed a handful of people, injured dozens of others, and displaced more than 1,500. But thanks to warnings issued by the Tonga Meteorological Services the day before, countless lives were saved. Still, this event shattered several world records. It created the most intense lightning storm ever recorded. The eruption also displaced a huge amount of seawater and generated global tsunamis. They reached countries such as New Zealand, Japan, Peru, and the United States. The blast created an air pressure wave so powerful, it traveled around the planet at least four times. It even moved clouds above the United Kingdom. The eruption was a massive event, says McKay. Exploring the deep. Curious about the eruption's impact, McKay led an expedition to the blast site. It took 6 days riding over rough waters aboard the research vessel I Tangora. When they arrived, they saw two patches on land, the islands Hunga Tonga and Hunga Haape. Between them lay the submerged crater of the volcano. It had remained remarkably intact. Given an explosion that violent, we would expect the volcano to have shattered, says McKay. The team also used Maxlimer, a remotely operated underwater vehicle, ROV, to examine the underwater effects of the eruption. The two vessels mapped approximately 8,500 square miles, 22,015 square kilometers, surrounding the volcano. This was when they made another unexpected finding. The seafloor around the volcano looked like a desert. The bottom was blanketed in a pale layer of fine debris. On much of the seafloor, within 19 miles, 30 kilometers, all life was extinguished, says McKay. After analyzing rock samples, they found the source of the devastation. As hot ash and gas fall down the side of a volcano, this creates powerful landslides known as pyroclastic flows. They are extremely hot and fast-moving, burning anything in their path. Underwater, these flows are called pyroclastic currents. The team found evidence of several pyroclastic currents coming from Hunga Tonga Hunga Haape's rim. They went over undersea hills and through valleys, with some of the flows traveling as far as 50 miles, 80 kilometers away. The ash from the volcanic eruption also affected ocean life. The ash contained nutrients that helped to fertilize ocean plants called algae. So many algae grew that a massive bloom could be seen in space. Most life, however, fares poorly when ash falls. It's toxic to many ocean animals and clouds up the water, making it harder for them to find food. Unfortunately, the pyroclastic flows also caused significant damage to Tonga's communication system. The eruption severed all underwater cables needed to access the internet. Families couldn't reach their loved ones on the islands, and Tonga couldn't send out information for 5 days after the explosion. The Goldilocks Zone. The surprising strength of the eruption left scientists questioning its unique nature. Was it a new type of volcanic eruption? What they found was the crater of this volcano sat at a depth of around 490 feet, 150 meters, making it perfectly placed for a supercharged explosion. A volcano's crater is the circular depression usually found above the vent that the eruption comes out of. The explosion occurred when the crater began collapsing. This let cold seawater rush into the hot magma chamber inside the earth. The salt water instantly expanded and turned into steam, which caused the immense force of the explosion. Any deeper than 250 meters, 820 feet, and water pressure will suppress the eruption. On the other hand, if it were shallower, the water wouldn't have had such a strong effect. This volcano is in what I like to call the Goldilocks zone, says McKay. With volcanoes, this zone is anywhere between 50 meters, 164 feet, to 250 meters, 820 feet, below sea level. In addition to the devastating impact of this eruption, scientists discovered that it also resulted in a new underwater volcano. It is located just 70 meters, 229 feet underwater, and is much closer to Tonga's capital. There's also a neighboring volcano, Volcano 3, that volcanologists are watching more closely now. At first, we didn't think this volcano would be a problem, says McKay. But knowing it lies within the Goldilocks zone means we must reassess the danger. Scientists still have a lot to learn about underwater volcanoes, but the eruption of Hunga Tonga Hunga Hoape is helping them to discover new things about how our Earth works. There's no question we will be studying the impacts of this volcano for years to come, says McKay. Unusual tsunamis triggered by this volcanic activity. The volcanic eruption of Hunga Tonga Hunga Hoape's unleashed a series of powerful tsunamis. The large waves flooded coastal areas and caused extensive damage to buildings and homes. Research shows that these waves may have begun as a single towering mass of water, around 295 feet, 90 meters tall. The collapse of the volcanic crater, with the ejection of material, caused water to rush in to fill that spot, launching this wave. Instruments positioned in various locations recorded the timing and immense size of these tsunami waves as they struck shores as far away as the Caribbean. Water level records were broken in Hawaii and California. The blast also triggered an immense, fast-moving air pressure wave. It traveled at 300 meters per second, 671 miles per hour. The force of the shockwave pushed seawater along its path, generating a second set of tsunamis. These fast-moving tsunamis arrived much quicker than predicted, challenging our current tsunami warning systems. It even rapidly changed air pressure around the globe. Scientists are now striving to improve these systems to detect pressure wave tsunamis. The hope is to give people potentially affected by a tsunami enough time to prepare for it and evacuate. Rachel Keough is a nonfiction writer from Burlington, Ontario. She is excited to see what new insights we can gain about underwater volcanoes and how this knowledge can help improve safety for coastal communities. Page 16, When a Volcano Screams, by Bill Gorgi. Methods to the Madness of Monitoring Volcanoes. On January 15, 2022, the Earth belched. It was a soda-gulping kind of burp, violent, loud, and sudden. But this event was not the usual carbonated beverage variety. It happened when bubbles of gas inside the Earth suddenly broke free. We know that volcanoes erupt because of bubbles, says Leif Karlstrom. He's a volcanologist and associate professor of earth science at the University of Oregon. It's like shaking up a bottle of soda. When the mostly underwater volcano Hunga Tonga Hunga Hawape erupted in the South Pacific, the plume shot up so high it reached the edge of space. Shockwaves from the explosive event circled the Earth four times in 6 days. An umbrella cloud of ash blanketed nearby Tongan islands. Tsunami waves stretched the breadth of the Pacific Ocean. And one short-lived island that had emerged during a different eruption in 2014 exploded into smithereens in the blast. The eruption was the Earth's biggest belt so far this century. Using technology and staying safe. But the planet-shaking belch wasn't a total surprise. Even though scientists couldn't predict the exact moment of this major eruption, they had had their eyes and ears on Hunga Tonga Hunga Hawape for years. They had noticed that it started to hiccup weeks earlier, in December 2021. Volcanologists, scientists who study volcanoes, are like detectives, gathering and analyzing clues to piece together a volcano's story. They monitor and study tiny crystals spit up by eruptions, the tremors that shake the earth, the gases that explode into the atmosphere, and even the sounds of subterranean distress. To gather clues, many volcanologists risk getting close to their fiery, volatile targets. Thankfully, advances in technology have made it possible to monitor volcanoes like never before and from safer distances. For instance, volcanologists now use specially equipped aerial drones to hover over land-based events and underwater robots to sidle up to submerged fissures. They use seismometers to sense when volcanian bellies rumble and shake, and thermal cameras to take their temperatures. They use ash detectors and gas sensors to track and study their emissions, and remote webcams to snap their images and record their voices. When Hunga Tonga Hunga Hawape began puffing fumes, scientists relied on one of their favorite remote sensing instruments, satellites equipped with cameras and radar, to safely monitor the natural fireworks. Volcanoes tend to be quite inaccessible and dangerous, says Karlstrom. It's not uncommon to lose sensors during an eruption. But satellites can keep a steady eye even on an erupting volcano without getting in harm's way. Satellites are just a game changer, Karlstrom says. Getting close. Scientists haven't always had so many tools to monitor volcanoes from a safe distance. Some of our most stunning photos and videos of lava flows and eruptions have come from a daring husband and wife team of volcano chasers, Katia and Maurice Kraft. For around 25 years, these French scientists trekked as close as humanly possible to the world's most active and dangerous volcanoes to record vivid footage. They also captured valuable data, including gas readings and mineral samples. But getting close to an active volcano is risky business. In 1991, the Krafts were killed by a massive pyroclastic flow. This is a wave of lava, stone, ash, and hot gas that can travel as fast as 400 miles per hour, almost 700 kilometers per hour. It happened on Mount Unzen, a volcano in Japan. One of the most daring attempts to unlock the secrets hidden in Earth's fiery bowels took place nearly a century ago. French scientific explorer Arpad Kirner was lowered by a rope made of fireproof material, asbestos, 800 feet, 244 meters, into the rumbling, fuming mouth of Stromboli, a volcano on a Mediterranean island off the coast of Italy. For protection, he wore a steel helmet, oxygen mask, and an asbestos suit. Stromboli is one of Earth's most active volcanoes. It has been erupting for 2,000 years, spewing nearly constant fountains of lava. While inside, Kirner took readings, including the temperature. The air was 150 degrees Fahrenheit, 65 degrees Celsius, and the rock 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. He also peered directly into the vent hole. There he saw an incandescent sea of liquid lava, agitated, boiling, shaken with convulsions, as he reported in April 1933 in the magazine Popular Science. By his own account, Kirner was fortunate to have survived. Cool new tools. For Carlstrom, volcanology is just another part of the family business. His father was an earth scientist, his grandfather a geologist who worked for the U.S. Geological Survey. As a third-generation earth scientist, Carlstrom has focused his career on volcanoes. He views them as primal systems that offer unique windows into the planet. They're also hard problems to solve. I like hard problems, he says. Plus, there's the hands-on aspect. Volcanology gives Carlstrom a chance to work in the field, like when he spent time on Mount Kilauea in Hawaii before it erupted in December 2020. Kilauea has been erupting occasionally ever since, most recently in June. You can go and stand on a volcano, he says, and you can poke at lava with your hammer. Carlstrom also runs computer models to analyze volcanic data. He uses many of the newest analytical tools available to volcanologists, like artificial intelligence and machine learning. Carlstrom's favorite tool is sound. He's especially captivated by volcano screams, eerie natural soundtracks. Besides being an earth scientist, Carlstrom is a professional musician and violinist. His musical ability enables him to approach volcanoes with a different lens or different earbuds. Volcanic datasets have a sort of musical structure to them, he says. Carlstrom applies his twin passions, volcanology and music, to his volcano listening project. It uses a process called sonification, the conversion of scientific data into sound. At Mount Redoubt in 2009, sonification helped him analyze unusual features in some sensor data. Seismic sensors near the summit of the volcano recorded a signal that started to go higher and higher in frequency, he explains. He applied sonification and listened. It sounded like a scream happening, and then it stopped. And then the eruption happened. Carlstrom views sonification as a way to get people excited about science. We live in this sort of weird time where science is polarizing and politicized, he said. There's nothing political about this. Music has a way of transcending biases and politics. For Carlstrom, sonification provides a way to bypass the traditional methods of presenting science, such as showing graphs. The concepts, I think, should appeal to everybody. I've applied it to volcanic data because I think it's compelling, he says. No kidding. When a volcano screams, everyone should listen. Science writer and novelist Bill Gorgi enjoys unearthing science past lost treasure. Like the stories of volcano chasers. When not plumbing science past, he likes to imagine science future. He still believes that just as technology got us into this, you name it, mess, so tech can get us out. especially with the help of today's inspiring kids. Page 20, Science at Work by Sarah Miller. Tricia Nato, volcanologist. Coolest job ever. No, make that the hottest job ever. As a volcanologist, Tricia Nato has a front-row seat to erupting volcanoes. Recently, these active volcanoes have included Hawaii's Mauna Loa that erupted in November 2022 and Kilauea that erupted in June 2023. Kilauea's recent event was the fourth in a string of eruptions since 2020. Nato researches the geologic impacts of volcanoes and the gases they produce. Her office is in one of the most beautiful and geographically diverse places in the world, Hawaii's Volcanoes National Park on the island of Hawaii. Hot molten lava and explosive displays are part of the job. The volcanoes can be unpredictable, making Nadeau's schedule sometimes irregular. We caught up with her early in the morning the week of Kilauea's eruption. This event had added to an already busy week for her. She'd just done a scheduled helicopter ride over Mauna Loa. Stunning 200-foot, 61-meter lava fountains are spewing from Kilauea again. Can you take us into Kilauea's eruption? Right now, in the daylight, the new liquid lava is shiny and silvery. The very hottest parts where you have those lava fountains show up as orange. When it hardens in the day, lava turns black. Then at night, anything liquid just glows in oranges, reds, and yellows. Fascinating! Tell us about your week. Here at the Volcano Observatory, we all rotate being duty scientists. That means we check the data and make sure things don't escalate for those out in the field. I took over on Tuesday, and that evening I received a text alert of seismic activity. We received warnings all through the night. Then around 3 a.m., activity ramped up so much that we changed the alert level. An hour later, lava showed up in the summit crater. Then I switched off that post and went into the field. The geology group goes in to sample the lava. Our group studies the gases. We were on the ledge, at the edge of the crater, looking down on the lava to measure the gases. Even though the lava is a few hundred meters below us, you could still feel the heat. Lava is 1,200 degrees Celsius, 2,192 degrees Fahrenheit. Where we were, you could still feel some warmth, about as hot as the sun on a summer day. What tools do you use? For gas, we can take a direct sample along the sides of a volcano, pulling it into a glass bottle. We sample the gas like this every couple of months to look for changes over time. We also use what's called remote sensing. It's similar to how one might use a camera because you're getting a picture or information from far away. We use an ultraviolet spectrometer, an instrument that uses light to determine something's composition, that gives us information using the sun. Depending on how much sunlight is absorbed by the volcanic gases, that's how we can tell how much gas is coming from an eruption. We also use drones. We can send a drone with a gas sensor into a plume, allowing us to go where we otherwise can't go as humans because it's dangerous. Is your job dangerous? It can be, but statistically, it's probably more dangerous to drive. We're trained when we do helicopter work, trained in first aid, and trained by people who work with volcanoes. No one's ever going to risk their life for data. For the gases, we always have gas masks with us. We have little monitors that tell us what the levels are. If it gets to a certain level, it will beep at us and we'll put our masks on. The gas can be dangerous. If the levels get too high, we just won't get data that day. In the field, we also wear bright orange clothes. That way, in case we need to be evacuated, a helicopter can see us. And we can be spotted by anyone looking for us. What events precede an eruption, like the one on Kilauea, and how do you measure what's happening? The summit area starts to fill up with magma, like a balloon. It fills up until it's ready to erupt. This is called deformation. It's how a volcano inflates and deflates. Many sensors, similar to GPS units, move in different directions, showing the different directions of the magma. The seismic group uses seismometers to register earthquakes. The activity record is different preceding an eruption. Many volcanoes can leak gases out before an eruption. We look at changes in the chemistry. Is there more carbon or sulfur? Are the proportions changing? These answers can provide clues as to whether or not a volcano is close to eruption. It's not a great method for Kilauea because of the type of volcano it is. With this volcano, the gas only comes out when the lava is also already coming out. But for many other volcanoes around the world, this technique works well because there can be bad health effects from these gases for people who live nearby. It's important we monitor them. We can warn people and report our findings to the public health authorities. How did you end up with a job as a volcanologist? I liked science as a kid. In eighth grade, I took an earth science class that covered geology, astronomy, and meteorology. I liked all these things. By the time college came, I was thinking about a geology or meteorology degree. Volcanoes, tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes. All those things were interesting to me. I liked the chemistry side, so geology was a better fit. Plus, I had an interesting professor who did amazing volcano stuff. So I went to grad school to study volcanoes and volcanic gases. I took on jobs that let me learn and work with volcanoes. I taught college classes and continued studying how volcanic gases dissolve in volcanic rocks. You don't have to live in Hawaii to work with volcanoes either. Wherever a kid lives, they can study what they're interested in. I lived in upstate New York and worked in a museum studying volcanoes. Or you can move where you're interested in. The important thing is to always keep learning. What's it like studying volcanoes for a job? It's exciting. My first day of work, I showed up during a major eruption. My colleagues had, just a week or so earlier, evacuated our main offices because of large explosions and earthquakes at the summit of Kilauea Volcano. This eruption lasted for more than 2 months. Not everyone gets to see these eruptions up close. Even if I get tired of other parts of the job like spreadsheets, budgeting, and writing papers, tasks like any other scientist or researcher has to do, the other days make up for it. Then you have these really amazing days, and even if you're tired at times, you get to see these eruptions and new earth being formed. Not many people get to do that. I try not to take that for granted. Hawaii is a great place to be because there is so frequently an eruption going on. I see my job as learning more about volcanoes and how they work so we can predict them better and keep people safe. Sarah Miller loves outdoor adventures and writing. At age 11, she interviewed neighbors about their pets, gardens, and hobbies for her The Neighborhood Scoop newspaper. Today, her writing has led her on up-close adventures with a hippopotamus and into river-filled caverns. An erupting Hawaiian volcano is now on her wish list. Page 26. Io's on Fire by Alice Andre Clark. Volcanoes in our solar system and beyond. Earth isn't the only place with volcanoes. Astronomers have found evidence of volcanoes on other planets and moons in our solar system, and even on exoplanets. These are planets outside our solar system that orbit other stars. Beyond Earth, we can see the inactive volcanoes that long ago carved out the landscape of planets and moons. We can also find some active volcanoes and a different, much chillier kind of volcano. Where is the biggest volcano in the solar system? Which celestial body is the site of the most volcanic activity in the solar system? Could all these volcanoes be a clue to where in space we might find extraterrestrial life? Mars, volcanic in a big way. Aside from Earth, Mars is the planet we know most about, geologically speaking. The Mariner 9 mission sent a spacecraft to orbit Mars in 1971. Its photographs showed this planet was home to volcanoes, calderas, or volcanic craters, and lava plains, or fields of lava left over after an eruption. For a long time, scientists assumed that these volcanoes were inactive. But in 2022, scientists studying orbital photos of Mars discovered an active volcanic formation. It meant that there must be a rising plume of hot rock beneath the crust. An elevated region of massive volcanoes called Tharsis covers one quarter of Mars. Volcanoes in Tharsis include Olympus Mons, the tallest volcano in the solar system. It's a shield volcano, which means it has a broad domed shape. Olympus Mons is as wide as the state of Arizona and has a peak that towers 16 miles, 25 kilometers above the surrounding plain. That's nearly three times the height of Mount Everest. Volcanoes on Mars are big for a couple of reasons. Because of the low gravity on Mars, volcanoes need very large magma chambers to generate enough pressure to produce an eruption. So when a volcano on Mars erupts, the eruption can be massive. Also, Mars' crust, unlike Earth's, doesn't move much over the hot spots underneath. On Earth, as the crust moves, one volcano will become extinct as another forms. But on Mars, lava has tended to pile up into one enormous volcano. Venus, crowded with volcanoes. One of our nearest neighbors, Venus, is loaded with volcanoes. Because of the thick cloud cover over Venus, we didn't know much about what its surface looked like until the 1990s. That's when the spacecraft Magellan mapped it with radar. In March, scientists announced they had found 85,000 volcanoes on Venus, far more than on any other body in the solar system. At least 80% of the planet is covered with lava flows. Venus has unusual features named pancake domes, flat, low surfaces up to 40 miles wide, 64 kilometers, formed by flows of sticky lava. Are any of these volcanoes still active? A 2020 analysis of the data from the 1990s Magellan mission to Venus identified 37 volcanic sites that might have been active in the last 2 to 3 million years. A 2021 study of the volcano Idan Mons found signs that it has erupted anywhere from 10,000 years ago to as recently as a few years ago. In 2023, scientists analyzing images of Venus from 1991 discovered changes in a volcano over that year, demonstrating that it was still active. Earth's moon has volcanoes too. When 17th century astronomers looked at the moon through telescopes, they saw wide dark features they mistakenly called seas. Those seas turned out to be lava plains. Because of the weak gravity on the moon, volcanoes have thrown lava much further than on Earth, forming plains and domes rather than tall volcanic mountains. Scientists once thought that the moon hadn't been volcanically active for billions of years, but one study identified some volcanoes that may have been active less than 100 million years ago and may one day be active again. Volcanic hotspot of the solar system. The most volcanically active place in the solar system is Jupiter's moon Io. Because Jupiter is so large, it has massive gravity that tugs on Io. Plus, nearby moons make Io's orbit wiggle. The constant push and pull of these forces causes friction under Io's surface that produces heat and leads to explosive eruptions. Because Io's gravity is so low, its volcanoes can emit spectacular curtains of fire, plumes that may shoot hundreds of miles above the surface. In December 2022 and spring 2023, NASA's Juno mission completed its first flybys of Io, which produced photos of Io's cracked surface and lava lakes. Additional flybys later in 2023 and 2024 will offer an even closer look. A little further out, icy volcanoes. Several other moons of planets beyond the asteroid belt also have active volcanoes, but these volcanoes are very different from the fiery ones found on Earth and Io. Neptune's coldest and largest moon, Triton, has an average surface temperature of -391 degrees Fahrenheit, -235 degrees Celsius. It's known for its cryovolcanoes. While many volcanoes on Earth erupt with melted rock as well as gases, cryovolcanoes spew out liquids and ice made of water mixed with substances that are usually gases on Earth. These include chlorine, ammonia, and methane. Moons with cryovolcanoes are likely to have liquid oceans underneath their surfaces. Scientists had once thought the interiors of cold planets and moons would be too frozen to erupt. But it turns out that the pull of gravity between planets and moons may create enough heat from the friction to allow for a liquid ocean that may sometimes erupt. The heat from decaying materials in a planet or moon's core might also cause cryovolcanic eruptions. Triton isn't the only moon with a lot of active cryovolcanoes. In 2005, the Cassini mission began getting close to eruptions on Saturn's tiny moon, Enceladus. Cassini scientists calculated that Enceladus has a 6-mile, 10-kilometer-deep ocean under a 19 to 25 miles, 30 to 40 kilometers of ice. A plume shooting out at 800 miles per hour, 1,287,000 kilometers per hour, contained mostly water vapor with a little bit of nitrogen, methane, and carbon dioxide. In 2023, the James Webb Space Telescope measured an Enceladus plume about 6,000 miles, 9,656 kilometers long, large enough to extend from Ireland to Japan. Scientists are also looking for volcanic activity on other moons. Recent research has identified volcanic features on Saturn's moon, Titan, as well as a heat source within the moon. This heat might cause the volcanoes to erupt. Titan also shows signs of a possible recent eruption. New evidence suggests another Jupiter moon, Europa, may have volcanoes on the floor of its vast subsurface ocean. Volcanic activity is particularly interesting to astronomers. Where there are active volcanoes, we are more likely to find life. Life-giving volcanoes. Why do volcanoes suggest an environment that can support life? Arizona State University geologist Christy Till explains, "Life needs a constant supply of some elements to grow and reproduce. One of those elements is phosphorus. On Earth, living things use it to maintain and repair their tissues and cells. They also use it to produce the genetic building blocks, DNA and RNA," says Till. Volcanoes play a key role in supplying phosphorus and other important elements. Till explains that volcanic activity can bring material and elements from inside a planet to its surface. Volcanoes can also change the composition of the atmosphere to make the environment more or less friendly to evolving life, she says. Beyond nature. Scientists think that Europa, Enceladus, and Triton are among the most likely spots in the solar system to host life. It might exist within their subsurface oceans, but the search doesn't stop at the edge of our solar system. In 2023, scientists discovered the exoplanet LP791-18d. It's located in the habitable, or Goldilocks, zone, not too near or too far from its star, that might support life. They have also found evidence that it is likely to have volcanoes. Many observers are hopeful that powerful new devices like the James Webb Telescope will be able to detect more exoplanets that might contain volcanoes and life. Alice Andre Clark is a writer in New Jersey. She really appreciated the opportunity to impress her son by getting a chance to write about something as cool as volcanoes in space. Page 30, Diamonds Buried Here, by Avery Elizabeth Hurt. The center of the Earth doesn't easily give up its secrets, but sometimes it does spew up diamonds. To find the good ones, though, you have to know where to look. Stephen Haggerty, a geologist at Florida International University, has discovered a strange plant in a West African jungle that could make finding diamonds a whole lot easier. tall plant, secret sign? Diamonds are forever, or so the song says. They are certainly old, from 1 to 3 billion years old. Diamonds are the hardest natural substance on Earth, and the purest ones are colorless. When you look at one in soft lighting, even if you aren't a romantic, you'll have to admit, diamonds are beautiful. They are also rare. Diamonds are found in kimberlite, a type of rock that forms when magma or molten lava cools. Kimberlite forms columns called pipes that reach deep into the earth. But it isn't easy to find kimberlite pipes. The dense jungle in West Africa makes searching for them even more difficult. If you've seen Tarzan movies, then you know what this place looks like, says Hagerty. After several years of working in the Liberian jungle, Hagerty started to realize that an unusual plant might be able to help people find diamonds. At 10 to 15 meters, 33 to 49 feet in height, it looks more like a tree than a plant. These are like plants on steroids, he says. It has a weird above-ground root system, spiny fronds, and is truly exotic-looking. The plant is called a pamea by the locals, who often use its leaves to roof their cottages. When Hagerty sent pictures to tropical plant specialists, he found out that its botanical name is Pandanus candelabrum. Not much is known about the group of plants it belongs to, but here's the thing. Hagerty saw the plants only in areas where locals were using picks and shovels to dig for diamonds. The locals don't mine the kimberlite pipes. That takes too much expensive equipment. Instead, they use picks and shovels to dig for lower quality diamonds that have washed free of the pipes. But the fact that the locals were finding diamonds hinted that there might be kimberlite pipes nearby. Hagerty designed a special plunger to poke down under the Pandanus candelabrum plant. He reports, "Sure enough, in between the roots, I found the kimberlite. I realized that these very unusual plants were growing right over the kimberlite, and so far at least, they haven't been found growing anywhere else." Not that simple. This was a great find. As Hagerty puts it, no kimberlite, no diamonds. But finding kimberlite doesn't necessarily mean finding diamonds. There aren't many kimberlite pipes on Earth, and of those, only a few have enough diamonds in them to be worth the trouble of mining. Diamonds are valuable, but it takes a lot of investment to get them, even if you find a good pipe, explains Stephen Sheary. He's a geologist at the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington, D.C. For example, you need big trucks to haul in the equipment used for mining, and just one tire of one of these huge trucks can cost $10,000, he says. But if you find kimberlite with lots of high-quality stones, diamond mining can be very profitable. Many of the countries where diamonds are mined could benefit from the revenue that diamonds can bring, says Sheary. Yet, due to problems like corruption and plundering, many Africans haven't benefited from the region's natural resources. In the late 60s and 70s, one of the world's largest diamond companies found three mines rich with diamonds in Botswana, a country in southern Africa. Botswana partnered with the company to share in the profits from the diamonds. But only this past July did they reach an agreement to split the profits equally in 10 years. Some people have criticized diamond companies for the way they treat local communities. When it comes to environmental issues, diamond mining gets less criticism. Diamond mining has two big virtues, says Sheary. The process is mechanical, not chemical, so there is no toxic waste, and diamonds are small, so you don't have to build lots of roads to get to them. If the exotic-looking Pandanus candelabrum turns out to be as good an indicator as Hagerty hopes, it could make searching for diamonds less intrusive as well. Just look under the pamea plants. Not just money. But the profits from diamonds are not limited to money. They can also give us valuable insight into our planet's development. Sheary studies diamonds, which were formed by great heat and pressure way below the surface of the Earth, to try to understand the deep geological forces that shaped the continents. We can't drill that deep, he says, so we have to learn from diamonds. Diamonds convey messages about our planet's history, and now it seems Pandanus candelabrum whispers messages about diamonds. Avery Elizabeth Hurt likes a sparkly diamond as much as the next person, but she's even more intrigued by those goofy-looking pomaea plants. Hurt lives in Birmingham, Alabama, and writes mostly about science for a variety of publications, including Muse. Page 34, Deadly Lakes by Gina Hagler. What are limnic eruptions? It's one of the rarest forms of volcanic activity, and among the most lethal. A limnic eruption occurs when a dangerous gas trapped at the bottom of a volcanic lake suddenly turns over and then escapes. This gas, carbon dioxide, is heavier than air. It's also colorless, odorless, and impossible to breathe. One limnic eruption at Lake Nyos in Cameroon, Africa, in August 1986, asphyxiated 1,700 people and 3,500 livestock overnight. This event alerted scientists to the threat and led them on a campaign to study and stop these killer lakes before history repeats itself. Conditions for a limnic eruption. These unusual but deadly explosions fall into the category of natural disasters. Limnic eruptions are rare because conditions for their formation must be precise. There must be a buildup of carbon dioxide, CO2, in solution in the cool waters at the bottom of a body of water, but not just any body of water. The water must be fresh water, not salt. The water must be very deep and still. Because this is essential to the limnic event, the body of water is often in the form of a crater lake, one that has been created by volcanic activity beneath the surface of the Earth. It's not enough to have a deep body of fresh water with a low salt content. There must also be a source of carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide usually enters the lake from the bottom in the form of gas from an underwater volcano. As more and more CO2 enters, the water becomes saturated with the gas. There is a limit to how much CO2 the water can hold while still remaining stable. As the limit is reached, conditions are ripe for a limnic eruption. Human-made explosives require a triggering event to get the explosive reaction going. The same is true with a limnic eruption. Something has to happen to start the reaction. This something will cause the release of gas in a very short amount of time. For a limnic eruption, it can be anything from an earthquake to a landslide to a violent rainstorm or even strong winds. Whatever the cause might be, it will disrupt the water and mix things up in the same way that shaking a bottle of soda agitates the CO2 inside. There is greater CO2 concentrations in the cooler, more pressurized waters at the bottom. So the more agitated the water becomes, the more likely it is that the waters and gases at the bottom will make their way to the top and into the air. Dangerous cloud. As the saturated water moves about and rises because of the action of the triggering event, the less dense water at the top of the body of water allows the release of the CO2 it holds. The release of that gas makes room for additional gas to rise to the top and be released. The more CO2 that is released, the more CO2 makes its way to the top. This occurs very quickly. The result is a huge cloud of carbon dioxide. This is not a typical cloud. This cloud is not going to rise because it's thick with CO2, which is denser than air. Because of this, the CO2 cloud sinks toward the Earth. As the cloud settles, fish and animals feel the effects. People do too. All of them have difficulty breathing. The limnic eruption happens so fast, there is no time to escape. Once the CO2 is released, animals and people nearby are at high risk of asphyxiation. Tragic examples. In modern times, limnic eruptions have occurred at two lakes in Cameroon. The first was at Lake Monoun. This eruption took place on August 15, 1984, and killed more than 30 people. On August 21, 1986, an eruption occurred at Lake Nyos. Much more CO2 was released, and the death toll was significantly higher. The cloud of CO2 gas was about 55 yards, 50 meters thick, and rose into the air at a speed of about 60 miles per hour, 97 kilometers per hour. After rising 130 yards, 119 meters above the shore, the cloud of CO2 followed the topography of the area, settling into low-lying areas. Most people died in their beds, but some people awakened. If their heads were above the CO2 cloud, they survived. One survivor said, "I managed to go over to my neighbor's house. They were all dead. I decided to leave. I didn't see any signs of any living thing." How to prevent disaster. Engineers have identified another body of water, Lake Kivu, as a likely site for a limnic event. It covers more than 900 square miles, 2,331 square kilometers, on the border of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. Lake Kivu has been flagged because it contains large amounts of CO2. In fact, scientists estimate it holds 1,000 times more than Lake Monon and Lake Nyos. The gas methane is also discovered in its depths. Methane can ignite when it hits the air. Efforts are being made to degas the lakes. Engineers have lowered plastic pipes to the bottom of Lake Monon and Lake Nyos. The tops of the pipes are attached to floating platforms on the lakes. Geysers of carbonated water rise to the surface and into the air on a continuous basis. Releasing the gas slowly and continuously helps prevent another deadly eruption. A similar process is taking place at Lake Kivu. At this large lake, an international group founded Project Kivu Watt. This is an effort to use the methane gas in the lake to generate power for the region. Gina Hagler writes about science for children and adults. She has a lifelong fascination with science and things that go boom. Page 36, Q&A by Lizzie Wade. Question: what would happen if a person were injected with plant cells? Zoe F. Answer: our bodies are good at defending against invaders. If you were injected with plant cells, your internal army, immune cells, would corner the intruders and slowly gobble them up, like they do with dangerous bacteria and viruses. Glenn Gaudette is a biomedical engineer at Boston College in Massachusetts. He says there's one part of a plant cell that wouldn't bother your immune system. It's thick, strong walls made up of a substance called cellulose. Gaudette doesn't study plants. He studies the heart, and especially ways to get it working again if it stops beating. In his quest to grow fresh heart tissue in his laboratory, he had a problem. He could get heart cells to survive and multiply in a petri dish, a shallow container where scientists grow bacteria and other microbes. But growing veins to bring blood to those cells was much trickier. One day at lunch, Gaudette noticed a spinach leaf in a student's salad. The leaf had a thick stem and a network of veins branching off that system. It looked just like what his heart cells needed. Plants need to transport water to the different parts of their leaves, just like the human body needs to transport blood to the different parts of the body, he says. He wondered, could the spinach veins made of cellulose carry human blood? To find out, Gaudette and his students stuck a needle down a spinach leaf stem and injected it with a mixture of soap and water. The mixture gradually washed away the guts of the plant cells, leaving behind only cellulose walls and veins. The result still looked like a spinach leaf, except it was completely see-through. Then, Gaudette dropped some heart cells onto the leaf, where they grabbed onto the cellulose structure. After a few days, the heart cells actually started beating. Gaudette injected red dye into the leaf's veins and watched it flow to all those cells. This proved spinach veins could, in theory, carry human blood to living human cells. It was really something, he says. Gaudette is still years away from making a spinach heart that could be implanted in a person. Still, he's already thinking about other plants that might help repair the human body. He's been trying to turn broccoli into lung tissue and bamboo into bone. So perhaps plant-human hybrids aren't so far away. Lizzie. Have any questions? Send them to Muse Q&A, 1 East Erie Street, Suite 525, PMB 4136, Chicago, Illinois, 60611, or email them to muse@cricketmedia.com. Page 37, Do the Math, Soccer Ball Fails by Ivars Peterson. Can you draw one? You've probably seen a soccer ball dozens, if not hundreds of times. So without looking at one, quickly sketch the pattern on a classic soccer ball. Now compare your drawing to the real thing. Did you get it right? Many people don't. They haven't paid close attention to a soccer ball's appearance, even though they may have often seen or played with one. A soccer ball's distinctive pattern of hexagons and pentagons is based on a mathematical shape called a truncated icosahedron. A regular icosahedron is a 3D, three-dimensional shape with 20 triangular faces, each one on an equilateral triangle. Icosa comes from the Greek word for 20. It has 30 edges and 12 corners. Note that 5 triangles meet at each corner. If you slice off or truncate each one of the 12 corners in just the right way, you end up with a truncated icosahedron. The resulting shape has 32 faces, 12 of which are pentagons with 5 equal sides, and 20 of which are hexagons with 6 equal signs. The pattern on a soccer ball typically features white hexagons surrounded by black pentagons. In this case, the faces are curved rather than flat, which means the ball is just about as round as a sphere. If you ask your friends to draw a soccer ball, you'll get all sorts of results. Even some tattoo artists have made mistakes. Annoyed by all the incorrect drawings out there, product designer and mathematical artist David Swart has provided the following advice to avoid errors. 1. Look closely at a real soccer ball. 2. Note the pattern has both pentagons and hexagons, not just hexagons. 3. Make sure that pentagons are surrounded by hexagons. Not all soccer balls have the classic design of hexagons and pentagons, however. One design, introduced for the 2014 World Cup, included just 6 curved panels. With fewer seams than a soccer ball stitched together from 12 pentagons and 20 hexagons, the new ball looked rounder and behaved more predictably. What's more, some soccer balls aren't actually sewn together from separate pieces, but are simply spheres with a printed pattern. How would you design the pattern? Ivars Peterson is a freelance writer and author of The Mathematical Tourist. He usually didn't resort to math when he was coaching his son's soccer team, but there's plenty of geometry found in the sport. Page 38, Big Blasts from the Past by Nick D'Alto. Volcanic eruptions that changed history, science, and our world. Volcanic eruptions can cause tragic loss of life, bring widespread destruction, and change the face of the earth itself. They can also reshape our weather, shift the balance of power between nations, and rewrite history. If we look closely enough today, we can see evidence of these giant explosions and their aftermath in the most unlikely places. They can be found in famous stories and works of art, and even in items we use every day. The 5 large eruptions described here made some of the most remarkable impacts of all. Using cutting-edge science and sifting through centuries of clues, modern-day experts have reconstructed these blasts from the past. Thanks to the insights we've gleaned, we can return to these incredible eruptions as they once were, minus the danger. We can better understand how volcanoes work and how they've reshaped our world. And we can learn how to help make people safer from them in the future. 1. The Stuff of Legend. Thera, the Aegean Sea, circa 1600 BCE. Volcanic Explosivity Index, VEI, 6 to 7. This was one of the most powerful eruptions in recorded history. The volcano spewed an estimated 150 billion tons of ash and rock into the sky. It reshaped the island of Thera, or Santorini, into a horseshoe shape and generated tsunamis that struck the island of Crete and other nearby areas. gas and debris from the eruption grew so thick in the atmosphere that, according to modern analysis, a lot of incoming sunlight got reflected back into space. That's right, the volcano dimmed daylight in the region. The eruption also changed the course of human history. Crete was the center of a leading early civilization, referred to as Minoan Crete, and made up of the Minoan people. The volcano and tsunami likely led to their collapse, allowing a more famous ancient people to rise to power, the Greeks. Yet the story of this volcano lives on even today. Have you heard the story of Atlantis? Scholars of ancient literature believe that Thera's near destruction of Crete may have helped inspire this legend. It's a tale about an advanced civilization that was lost when their island home was destroyed in a disaster and then swallowed by the sea. Sound familiar? 2. A Lost World Found. Mount Vesuvius, Italy, 79 CE. VEI 5. The incredible eruption of Mount Vesuvius occurred during the reign of the Roman Empire. It released a plume of gas, ash, and rock around 20 miles, 32 kilometers high. For many hours after the eruption, ash and pumice, a glassy rock, pelted the nearby Roman city of Pompeii. It was a bustling tourist center filled with shoppers and restaurant patrons. As mobs of terrified people fled for the sea, roofs collapsed. Then a cloud of furnace-hot gas blew through another Roman town, Herculaneum. When the disaster was over, both doomed cities lay buried under mountains of rubble. We know what happened at Pompeii thanks to an incredible eyewitness account, researched and written by a teenage survivor named Pliny. He interviewed other survivors and described his uncle's heroic efforts to try to rescue people by boat. When modern archaeologists finally dug Pompeii and Herculaneum from the rubble, they found both cities eerily preserved. Though many buildings had flattened, some rooms remained mostly intact, filled with unbroken pottery, artwork, and even a chariot. Some victims died carrying coins and jewelry. Well-preserved bodies reveal how some people hid inside homes and shops, while others ran for their lives trying to escape the eruption. Frozen in time, Pompeii and Herculaneum provide remarkable glimpses into how people lived long ago. A modern scientific laboratory, the Vesuvius Observatory, monitors volcanic activity in the region to help keep people there safe from future eruptions. 3. A Year Without Summer. Mount Tambora, Indonesia, April 1815, VEI 7. The eruption of Mount Tambora was the largest eruption in recorded history, and perhaps in 10,000 years. It sent a column of rock and ash halfway to space as lava poured down the mountainside. But this volcano's destruction didn't stop there. Its blast spewed so much debris into the atmosphere that it cooled the temperature of Earth itself. That's right. It literally changed the world's climate, setting off a series of astonishing weather events. In June 1815 in Europe, heavy rains contributed to French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte's loss in the Battle of Waterloo. In Europe and North America, the following year of 1816 became known as the Year Without a Summer. In New York, snow fell in June. In Virginia, founding father and former U.S. President Thomas Jefferson, who had retired to run a farm, noted in his diary that frequent frosts had damaged his crops. Food shortages swept the globe. Horses' health suffered too, and people needed new ways to get around. So a German inventor devised a new way to travel, the bicycle. And in Switzerland, the gloomy weather inspired a young woman and her friends who were stuck inside while on vacation to write creepy stories. Mary Shelley created a memorable new character and the seed of a story that would become the famous novel Frankenstein. All this occurred largely because a volcano had erupted half a world away. 4. Incredibly Loud. Krakatoa, Indonesia, August 1883, VEI 6. This massive eruption released as much energy as 200 megatons of TNT and destroyed most of the island that had surrounded the volcano. After a series of violent explosions, a final mighty blast is believed to have been the loudest sound ever heard by human ears. It could be heard nearly 3,000 miles, 4,828 kilometers away. Krakatoa also unleashed tsunamis that brought destruction across the Pacific and killed more than 30,000 people. The then-new worldwide telegraph network sent news of the disaster everywhere, making Krakatoa one of the world's first global news stories. One surprising effect occurred high in the atmosphere from sulfuric acid and ash spewed by the volcano. This led to bizarrely colorful sunsets around the world. Painter Edvard Munch likely saw one of these sunsets in his native Norway. Art historians believe that he used it as the background for his famous 1893 painting, The Scream. This artwork is so popular today that it appears on posters and t-shirts. Now you know that a volcano likely helped inspire this striking image. 5. A comeback from fury. Mount St. Helens, Washington, May 18, 1980. VEI 5. A key volcanic event in U.S. history, the eruption of Mount St. Helens, took place just a few decades ago in Washington state. Before the eruption, an earthquake unleashed the largest landslide in recorded history. The top of the mountain fell away, leaving less rock to contain the volcano's fury. The resulting explosion spread destruction for hundreds of square miles. It caused widespread damage to forests, lakes, rivers, crops, and livestock. In populated places, volcanic mudflow damaged roads and bridges. Thankfully, many people had evacuated, but 57 lost their lives. The lands surrounding Mount St. Helens have recovered surprisingly well. New forests have grown, and wildlife continues to return to the region. And many of the rural areas affected by Mount St. Helens have recovered and been rebuilt. In the decades since the eruption, modern-day experts have had a chance to see how nature and civilization can sometimes mount a successful comeback, even after being rocked by a volcano's fury. Volcano-fried pizza fizzles. Italian archaeologists have not discovered the earliest evidence of pizza, it turns out. A wall painting recently unearthed in the volcano-ruined city of Pompeii appeared to show an ancient dining scene that included fruit, wine, and a delicious-looking pizza just waiting to be served. Today, pizza is a wildly popular dish in many countries. In Italy, pizza sales generate billions of euros each year. But around 2,000 years ago, when Pompeii was buried, there were some missing ingredients. Tomatoes are native to North America and didn't reach Italy until explorers brought them back in the 1500s. Mozzarella cheese likely wasn't invented until around the same time. So pizza, as we know it today, didn't exist during the Roman Empire. Food historians now suggest the Pompeii painting may show a focaccia, a kind of leavened flatbread that is still enjoyed today. Volcanic Explosivity Index. The Volcanic Explosivity Index, VEI, measures the explosiveness of a volcano's eruption. It reflects an eruption's magnitude and intensity, and its scale is mostly on par with the Richter scale's measurement of earthquakes. Here is the VEI list according to the U.S. National Park Service. VEI description. 0. Effusive. 1. Severe. 2. Explosive. 3. Catastrophic. 4. Cataclysmic. 5. Paroxysmal. 6. Colossal. 7. Megacolossal. 8. Apocalyptic. Nick D'Alto is a science writer who resides in New York State. He enjoyed learning about the power and impact of volcanoes while living very far away from them. Page 42, The Curious Case of the Missing Volcano, by Abha and Deepa Jain. A massive volcano can't just vanish, or can it? Fiery volcanoes and the frigid polar region seem poles apart. But concealed in the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets are mementos, ash and sulfate particles from past super-powerful volcanic eruptions. During such eruptions, volcanoes spew material dozens of miles into the sky. The swirling of winds disperse these chemicals and ash over continents all the way to the poles. When snow falls there, the material is also deposited. In ice cores, cylinders of ice drilled from ice sheets, sulfate from past volcanic plumes show up as spikes. Measuring how intense each spike is helps scientists figure out how strong each eruption was. In the 1970s, polar scientists stumbled upon a sulfate spike that occurred in roughly 1259. Unlike others, though, this one was ginormous. It dwarfed the spike from the ear-splitting 1883 eruption of Mount Krakatoa in Indonesia. The eruption was one of the largest of the last millennium, says Celine Vidal. She's a volcanologist, a scientist who studies volcanoes. She also lectures about geography at the University of Cambridge in England. The amount of material erupted would have buried New York City under about 8 feet, 2.5 meters of rocks and ash. Medieval European accounts also provided indirect evidence for an enormous eruption at around the same time. Severe hailstorms and floods plagued eastern England and parts of Europe in the winter of 1260 to 1261. From Iceland to Italy, ice layers crusted over seas and rivers. There was just one problem. Nobody seemed to have reported seeing a volcano erupting. So where was the missing volcano? No suspects fit the bill. Volcanologists started zeroing in on possible suspects. They realized that the enormous sulfate spike appeared in both the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets. So the Perp volcano was likely located near the equator. An Alaskan volcano, in contrast, would likely only have an Arctic sulfite spike signature. Also, the ash was rich in a mineral called silica. This meant the eruption had been explosive. The volcano had flung rocks high into the sky. Scientists then tried to match the mystery volcano's ash with ash from still-standing tropical volcanoes. Such comparisons rely on the fact that each volcano spews out ash with a unique chemical composition. The ash acts like a volcano's fingerprint. One of the volcanoes the scientists examined was El Chicón in Mexico. Another was Quillota in Ecuador. But the geochemical fingerprint of their ash didn't match that of the ice-embedded ash grain, says Vidal. Volcanologist sleuths were stumped. For them, this cold case was only getting colder. A lucky break. Years passed without researchers getting any closer to finding the culprit. Then in the early 2010s, a team of scientists had a flash of genius. They'd flipped the search. Instead of matching ash samples, they would focus on the source of the ashes, the volcano. They would ID traits the mystery volcano should have had before and after the mega eruption. Then they'd search for possible candidates with these features. In other words, they would use general attributes to find the specific volcano. This thinking is called deductive reasoning. One step the volcanologists took was calculating how much rock the eruption would have thrown out or ejected. They estimated it was around 10 cubic miles, 40 cubic kilometers of material. That's an incredible 10.5 trillion gallons, 40 trillion liters, roughly twice the volume of Crater Lake in Oregon. Much of this material was a light volcanic rock called pumice. This meant thick layers of pumice had to surround the volcano they were looking for. But this volcano wouldn't be much of a volcano anymore. The calculation also showed that such a powerful eruption would have blown the volcano's vent right off. In other words, researchers should have been hunting not for a mountain, but for a caldera. Calderas are craters that form after powerful eruptions. Crater Lake is one, too. Just before this type of explosion, the underground chambers are literally bursting with magma. But once the chambers are emptied, overlying rocks collapse inward. One more part of the puzzle was the eruption date. Other researchers built computer models to study how the climate changes after volcanic eruptions, including the Mystery Eruption. They found that it had probably happened 2 years earlier, in 1257. This explained some odd medieval accounts that recorded unusually bad weather in 1258, several months before 1259. Nabbing the culprit. Buoyed by these new leads, volcanologists started to hunt afresh. What about Africa? Nope. There were no explosive volcanoes there. Latin America? Another no. Though there were many candidates, none showed signs of a 13th century mega eruption. Then the team turned to Indonesia. This tropical string of islands is pockmarked by calderas. Among the short list of suspects from this archipelago, one stood out. The remains of Mount Samalas on Lombok Island. Just a short distance from the Indonesian capital, Bali, this caldera was just the right size. It was about 51 square kilometers, 20 square miles. That's 15 times larger than Central Park in New York City. When volcanologists visited the island, they found more evidence for a very violent eruption. Layers of solidified lava showed that the volcano had belched out molten material the weight of a billion elephants, all within hours. What's more, ash on neighboring islands suggested plumes of debris had shot 27 miles, 43 kilometers, into the sky. That's four times higher than the cruising altitude of commercial planes, says Vidal. And layers of pumice, 115 feet, 35 meters thick, had been deposited miles from the Samalas caldera. Still, more proof came from tree branches trapped in the pumice. Researchers measured the amounts of two types, or isotopes, of carbon in these branches. This could tell the age of the branches and hence when the eruption happened. Data from this carbon dating technique showed the eruption probably occurred in the middle of the 13th century, a close enough match. Even the ash from the Mount Samalas eruption had the same chemical mix as the samples from the polar ice cores. The clincher? Special documents called babad, written on palm leaves. Babad are stories, tales, or legends from previous generations written down, says Muhammad Ngalnul Malawani. He's a geography researcher at Gajah Mada University in Indonesia. Three babad from Lombok shared the same core, the story of the Samalas eruption. Finally, the massive volcano had been found. Many other past eruptions remain enigmas, but the 1257 case has been closed at last. Hot inside, cold outside. Volcanic ash in the upper layers of the atmosphere can block sunlight and heat. This makes summers colder than usual. Trees show stunted growth. Harvest of crops may also be poorer. Many powerful eruptions can even have a feedback effect on the climate. This means that once things start getting cold, they may get even colder. For instance, computer models imply that the cooling caused by many eruptions in the 13th century, including the mystery one in this article, increased the amount of Arctic ice. The larger amount of ice cut off ocean currents from the Atlantic that brought warmer water. This, in turn, created even more sea ice, which cut off the currents even more. The result? The North Atlantic entered the Little Ice Age, a period of cold weather. Many missing volcanoes. Dozens of sulfite spikes, apart from the Samalas one, appear in polar ice cores. Historical records also note periods of strange weather around the same time as the spikes, but the eruptions behind many of these changes remain unknown. One example is from the 1450s. Just as in the 1257 eruption, northern Europe suffered from miserably cold weather in the middle of the 15th century. Geologists have probed volcanoes around the world, yet the culprit is still on the lam. Abha and Deepa Jain are a twin team of science writers. They love mysteries, even those that are 800 years old. Page 47, Your Tech by Catherine Hulick. Will a supervolcano destroy the world? At Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, wide-eyed tourists snap photos as geysers spew hot water and steam into the air. Yet something ominous lurks beneath their feet. It's what powers the geysers and heats the hot springs. It's a supervolcano. Around 8.7 million years ago, it exploded with a force that broke open the land with streams of lava. Gas and ash spewed into the air. Volcanic glass rained down over an area the size of New Jersey. Any animals or plants in this area were buried and most likely vaporized. Fine ash fell over the entire United States and spread in the air around the globe, altering the weather worldwide. A supervolcano is a volcano that produces a massive eruption measuring 8, the largest possible, on the Volcanic Explosivity Index, VEI. A supervolcano has an unusually vast pool of hot magma underground. After an eruption, it leaves behind a wide hole in the earth called a caldera. Supervolcano eruptions are rare. Earth experiences one about every 100,000 years. Could a massive volcanic event destroy life as we know it? Around 252 million years ago, around 90% of all life on the planet died out. It was the biggest mass extinction event ever, nicknamed the Great Dying. Scientists think that what caused it was a long-lasting volcanic event. If a supervolcano were to erupt today, it would burn everything within 60 miles, 100 kilometers. Its ash would kill crops, dirty water, clog up electronics, prevent airplanes from flying, and cause health problems like eye or skin irritation and lung disease. The ash would also block sunlight, leading to climate changes that would be devastating. In the distant past, the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted every 500,000 years or so. Its most recent major eruption happened 630,000 years ago. But you can breathe easy. Right now, it's still dormant. Researchers have shown that the rate of eruptions there has slowed down considerably. They think we probably have around 900,000 years before another massive eruption occurs. Phew! Volcanoes are notoriously unpredictable, though, so scientists are keeping an eye on the area for warning signs. Jacob Lowenstern is a research geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Vancouver, Washington. He previously held the title of Scientist in Charge at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. He says, "There's no current activity that's going on that would indicate anything is happening. So for now, it's still safe to visit the park and snap photos." Catherine Hulick has never been to Yellowstone National Park, but she'd love to go stand on top of the supervolcano someday. When she's not writing books and articles about science for young people, she spends time with her family, pet dog and snake, and many houseplants. This has been Muse for October 2023. I'm Jane Malucci for Chris.